Well, now we have a thesis written in the year 1882 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled A Possible Criticism of the Concept of Atomism. He starts by saying, writing that he says, modern natural science considers experience as the single source for the investigation of truth. And this certainly not incorrectly. Its domain is the kingdom of external spatial things and time processes. What should one be able to constitute about an object which belongs to the external world without first having learned to know it in the midst of sense perception? That is the single way with which you can come in contact with the object in a space-time way. First, you have to learn the object, learn to know the object, and then to theorize about it. That is how the maxim sounds, which the modern science has made itself valid against the speculative system of the natural philosophers. This particular idea of knowing the object first and theorizing about it afterwards, that has made itself valid from the beginning of this century. This principle is absolutely justified. However, it has, through an incorrect grasping of it, it has led science into abwege, paths away from the proper paths. The misunderstanding lies in the character which is attributed to the inductive method, and that materialism and atomism which flows out of it. And the inductive method and the materialism and atomism which flows out of the inductive method has led to a misunderstanding of the character of the allgemeine Begriffen, the universal concepts. And now for those people who have insight, there can be no doubt that the present position of natural science in its theoretical part is essentially influenced by those concepts which have become dominant as a result of Kant. If we would go much more deeply into this relationship, so we must begin our considerations with Kant. Kant limited the domain of knowledge to that of experience because he found in the mediated sense substance which was present in experience the single possibility to fill in, to fill up his categories. Those categories that exist in our intellectual organization and in themselves are completely abstract concepts. In our intellectual spiritual organization, there exists categories. These have quite our empty concepts. And to fill these empty concepts up, the only source you have are in that which is mediated to us by the sensual substances. Now with that, he has directed the judgment of the world into other paths. Whereas previously, the concepts and the laws were thought of as belonging to the external world. And one previously had ascribed objective validity to the concepts and ideas and laws. Now they, according through Kant, these concepts and laws seem to be given only purely and simply through the nature of our ego. The external world was valid purely as a raw substances, yet as that which alone you can ascribe reality alone to the external world. This standpoint Kant had inherited from the inductive science. As far as inductive science is concerned, it also considers the material world as alone being of a real nature. And with the inductive science, concepts and laws are only insofar justified as it has as its content the concepts and the laws have as their content the material world, and are able to mediate knowledge of this material world. Any concepts which go beyond this realm, it considers as unreal. Universal thoughts and laws are, as far as she is concerned, as far as this inductive science is concerned, pure abstractions deduced from a series of experienced observations. And these general concepts and general laws are abstractions arranged in conformity with the experienced observations. Objective science recognizes only subjective maxims, subjective generalizations, but does not recognize concrete concepts carrying in themselves their own validity. Now, all this must be considered. If out of a collection of dark or dimmed concepts which are circulating today, one wants to progress forward to complete clarity. In the first place, one has to ask oneself the following question. What then is this actual experience which has been won from this or that object? Now, in all the treatises or works about the experience philosophy, one will seek in vain for a factual, satisfactory answer to this most certainly justifiable question, namely, what actually then is experience which is one this and this object? The average philosophy of experience has no real satisfying answer to this question. Now, to cognize the essential nature of an object of the external world, it is impossible for this to mean that to perceive this object with the senses, and so as it represents itself, produce of it a counterfeit, a counterpicture, a counterfeit. One will never be able to see into the fact how there can arise from a sense, from a sense object, how there can rise from this sense object a corresponding conceptual photograph, and what connection could exist between these two, between the object and its correspondingly conceptual photograph. A theory of cognition which starts off from this standpoint can never get into a pure understanding about the question of the connection of concept and object. Now, how ought one to see into the necessity to pass over from that which is directly given through the senses, and to pass over from that to the concepts, to the concept, if in that which is given to the senses already the essential nature of an object of the sense world is already given? Why do we need any form, any concepts, if the perception alone is sufficient? You could, in that case, consider the concept as a highly unnecessary addition to the object, or you might consider it to be a falsification of the object. You must logically arrive at that if you're going to deny the concreteness of concepts and laws. Now, you know that the school of Herbart says the concept is the spiritual correlate of an object existing outside of ourselves, and cognition consists in the achievement of such a picture. Now, in confrontation with such a picture explanation, let us now seek for a real explanation of cognition. The task which we're going to set ourselves here is going to limit itself purely to the cognition of the external world. In the act of cognition, in this case, two things in consideration. And thus, the act of cognition involves, in this case, two kinds of things. Namely, the corroboration of thinking and that of the senses. The thinking has to do with concepts and laws, and the senses have to do with sense qualities and processes. The concept and the law are always of a universal aspect. The sense object is something of a special nature, is something special. The concept and the law can only be thought about, produced by thinking, but the sense object can only be looked, perceived. The media through which the universal appears to us as something special, the media responsible for the universal becoming special are space and time. Because of space and time, we have a specialization of the universal. Every special thing and every specialized process must be capable of being inserted into inserted into the conceptual content. The conceptual content has to be inserted into every special thing and every special process. I'm not quite clear what he means here. I think he means that every special thing and every special process must be capable of being inserted into the conceptual content of the world, because that of the special thing and special process which is not capable of being grasped by law or by concept does not at all come into consideration for our thinking. Because of that, the cognition of an object for us can only mean the following: that which appears to our senses in space is permitted to completely go up into the general universal, the universality of the conceptual content of the world. That which appears to our senses in space must be capable of going into, dissolving itself, or going into, being absorbed by the universe, made into the universality of the conceptual content of the world. In the cognition of a space-time object is thus to us nothing else other than given as a concept or a law in a sensual way. That when you cognize a space-time object, that is a sense way of imparting to us a concept or a law. only through a fact that such a, only through such a way of grasping things can you transcend the previously mentioned unclarity. One must permit the concept to have a primal origin and to permit it to be built upon its own form of existence, and then to recognize it in the sensual object only in another form. Now, in this way, we have arrived at a real definition of experience. The philosophy of induction can, according to its nature, never arrive at such a real definition of experience, because it must be shown in which way the experience mediates concept and law. Since, however, this philosophy of induction regards both these as purely subjective, so from the very beginning they have cut off the path to achieving an understanding. Out of that, one sees at the same time how unfruitful would be the undertaking to make something about the external world without the help of perception. How can one take hold of the concept in the form of perception without oneself bringing to fulfillment the perception itself? First, only when you see into the fact that concept and idea is what is the perception offers, however, in an essentially other form than what the perception offers is something of entirely different form from that which is offered by the pure thinking which has been freed from all empirical content, and that this form is the determining factor. When you realize that, then you realize that you must go upon the path of experience. However, if one assumes that the content is the determining factor, is decisive, then nothing can be placed against the assertion that the same content still can be acquired upon another way than upon a way entirely free from all independent of experience. Thus, experience must well be the maxim of natural philosophy. You can't do without experience. But at the same time, the cognition of the concept in the form of external experience must also be its maxim. And here it is, where the modern science, through the fact that it doesn't seek for a clear understanding of experience, because of that, it comes upon erroneous ways. Because it cannot form a clear concept of experience, then it can easily be attacked. Instead of recognizing the a priori nature of the concept and grasping the sense world only as another form of the concept, instead of doing that, it considers the external world as the absolute priority and the concept as being derived from the external world. Thus, the mere form of something is labeled as the thing itself. And out of this unclarity of the ideas proceeds atomism, insofar as it is of a materialistic nature. We want here to subject atomism, supported by what we have just presented to you, we want now to subject atomism to a possible, as I believe to be, a possible criticism. Now, it doesn't matter what all the different opinions might be on the subject, finally, atomism arrives at the fact of regarding all such sense qualities as sound, warmth, light, smell, etc. Indeed, when one sees on the way in which the mechanical warmth theory of the Mariotte law has been deduced, even pressure, all these things, sound, warmth, light, smell, warmth, even pressure, as a pure shine, as a pure function, a pure apparency, a pure function of the world of atoms. The atom itself is validated as the ultimate factor of reality. Now, if one wants to be logical, this atom, one must remove from this atom all possibility of sense qualities. Because otherwise, you're explaining something out of itself. However, you discover that when people set about building up an atomistic world system, they attribute to the atom all kinds of sense qualities, although only in a quite spare abstraction. They attribute to the atom all kinds of sense qualities, even though it's just a sparse aspect of these sense qualities. Nevertheless, they do attribute to the atom some sense qualities, which is illogical, because then you ought to remove all sense qualities if you want to say that the atom is the ultimate reality. If you have the atom with certain sense qualities, then you're explaining a thing out of itself. At one moment, they consider the atom as impermeable and auskadent. That means occupying space, I'm sure. It means expansive. It's actually auskadent. It means here that one time you consider the atom as being impermeable and auskadent, which means occupying some space, and then at other time they consider the atom purely as a center of forces. With that, they are perpetrating the greatest illogicalness, and they show, and it shows that what I have shown quite clearly in the foregoing, that you should not attribute to the atom any sense attributes. They have not considered that, but they have put sense attributes on the atom. The atom must have an existence which is inaccessible to sense experience. On the other side, the atoms themselves, and also those processes which are going on in the atomic world, the world of the atoms, those special movements, nothing is supposed to be of them of a conceptual nature. The concept is indeed purely universal, without any space existence. However, the atom is supposed to be, if itself not of a spatial nature, nevertheless must be in space itself, and thus presenting something quite special. It ought not to be not yet exhausted in its concept, but beyond itself it must have a form of existence in space. And with that, is the concept of the atom has taken up a quality which destroys itself. It is supposed to exist analogous to the objects of external perception, and yet it is not capable of being perceived. In its concept, it is at the same time affirmed and denied in its possibility of being perceived. Besides that, the atom immediately announces itself as a purely product of speculation. Now, if one disregards what was mentioned previously, namely the completely unjustifiable attribution of sense qualities, then it remains for the atom nothing left over than a mere something, etwas, a mere pure etwas, a pure something, which of its naturally is unchangeable, because with it there is nothing. Thus, nothing of it can be destroyed. The thought of the pure existence, which is transposed in space, a pure thought point, in the main, only the very well loved, well often repeated Kantian thing and itself, this is what confronts us. On the other hand, one could object something to the opposite to that, that it is then quite indifferent what is being understood under the term atom. One should permit the natural historian, the nature historian, to operate operate with it. Since for many tasks of mathematical physics, the atomistic concepts are of advantage. The philosopher indeed knows, finally, that one is not concerned here with a spatial reality, but with an abstraction similar to other mathematical concepts or ideas. Against the assumption of an atom, to oppose the assumption of the atom in this regard would be to be sure wrong. However, that's not what it's concerned about here. Here we're concerned with that atomism which are as atom and causality the single possible mainsprings of the world, which either denies everything which is not of a mechanical nature, or nevertheless considers it as unexplainable, going beyond our capacity for cognition. It is one thing to regard the atom as a pure thought point, but quite another thing to see in it the fundamental principle of all existence. The standpoint of the atom as a pure thought point doesn't go beyond the mechanical nature, but the point of view of regarding the atom as a fundamental principle of all existence considers the atom as having a mechanical function. The person who wants to speak about the non-damaging nature of the atomistic ideas, that person, one can allow him to have the consequences which are naturally, logically deduced out of it, and hold those consequences in front of him in order to refute him. There are primarily two necessary consequences. The first, that the predicate of the primal existence is wasted on further whole indefinite confronting each other indifferent spiritless single substances, in which the interchange is dominated only by mechanical necessity, so the whole remaining world of phenomena consists out of empty vapor and owes its existence to a pure accident. That's the first consequence. And the second, yields itself about the borders, limits of our knowledge, which we cannot tread over. For the human intellect is, as we've shown, the concept of the atom is something quite empty for the pure something, the pure etwas. How but with this content the atomists cannot be satisfied, but require a factual content, but they so determine this content as it never can exist. And so they must proclaim the unknowingness of the actual nature of the atom. In reference to the other limit of knowledge, we have to notice the following. If you regard thinking as a function of the interchange, interwork, interaction of atom complexes which confront each other, so it is absolutely not to be wondered why the connection between the movements of the atom, on the one hand, cannot be grasped by thinking and perception, which regards atomism, hence, as a border, a limit of our knowledge. Alone to be grasped is only that something which consists of a conceptual transition. If, however, previously you so limit the concepts that one cannot find itself over into the sphere of the other, you can't find anything which makes possible the transition from one sphere into another. So, from the very outset, you have excluded the understanding of it. Besides that, the passing over from one to the other must not be a something of a purely speculative nature, but it must be a real process capable of allowing itself to be demonstrated. This, however, is again prevented through the concept of the nonsense nature of the atomistic movements. By giving up the concept of the atom, the speculations about the limits of our knowledge are also removed. One must protect oneself from such determination of the limits, because if you say that, then you can make a place, if you have limits, then you can make a place for all sorts of things as existing on the other side of the limits of knowledge. That spiritism, which is the most objectionable, that spiritism which opposes one's reason, is quite as possible. You can assume the existence of spiritism, which opposes reason. You consider that existing behind the limits of knowledge. Also, the most nonsensical dogma you can assume as existing behind those limits. These can all, in any case, be easily disproven, opposed, insofar as you show that always there lies at the base the mistake of regarding a pure abstraction for more than it is, or of holding purely relative concepts for absolute concepts, and lead to similar errors. A large number of false ideas has come into existence as a result of the incorrect concepts of space and time. Hence, we must subject these two concepts of space and time to a discussion. The mechanical nature explanation requires the assumption of its world of atoms, or the assumption of the world of atoms, besides the atoms conceived to be in motion, you require an absolute space which is a pure vacuum, and an absolute time which is an unchangeable measurement of that which precedes one after the other. What is space? The only possible answer could be space is absolute extension. To be sure, this is a property of sense objects, and disregarding this, a pure abstraction. Only there on and with objects, and not by the side of objects, as atomism of necessity must assume. If extension is supposed to exist, so there must be something which is extended, and this cannot again be the extension itself. One can raise the objection, as, for example, the Kant's notion of the proof of the absoluteness of space by using the two gloves, the left-hand glove and the right-hand glove. One says the parts have the same relationship to each other, and nevertheless you cannot bring them to complete covering, Deckung. Out of that, Kant concludes that the relationship to absolute space is something different, and consequently this is valid. However, it's much closer to assume that the relationship of the two gloves to one another are of such a nature that they cannot be brought to complete Deckung, complete covering. How should also a relationship to absolute space be thought and assumed and selbst angenommen? It would be possible so to establish the relationships of both gloves to an absolute space, and again to each other. Why should not this likewise be something of a primal nature? Space, disregarding, looked apart, der Raum, space, when you looked apart or disregarding space, taking space and disregarding it from things of the sense world, that is a non-thing. How space only is given in objects, so is also time given only and with processes of the sense world. They are immanent in both. They are both immanent, and in themselves they're both purely abstractions. Concrete structures of the sense world are only the sense things and processes. They represent concepts and laws in the form of external existence. Hence, they must, in their simplest form, be the fundamental pillars of empirical nature science. The simple sense quality, and not the atom, is the fundamental fact, and not the simple sense quality, and not the atom. The fundamental facts, and not the empirical movement behind them, these are the elements of it. Hence you are given a direction which is a single possible direction. If you rest upon that, you will not be tempted to speak of the limits of knowledge, because you are not dealing with things which you attribute in an arbitrary manner such negative properties as of a supersensible and like that, but you are dealing with real given concrete objects. Out of these indications, there will yield itself also important consequences for the theory of knowledge. Above all stands fast, solid, that the atom and the movements, the empirical movements of the atom, must be exchanged for the sense fundamental elements of external experience, and can no longer be valid as the principles of natural science. This thesis was written in 1882, and here we have a letter which Rudolf Steiner sent to Friedrich Theodor Fischer accompanying this thesis. And the letter is dated Vienna, the 20th of June, 1882. And he reads it, "Your esteemed sir, noble Herr Professor, your esteemed sir will forgive me if a complete person unknown to you dares to direct this writing to you and for his justification doesn't add anything further, because to him this action can only be excused if the noble Herr Professor will take it as such. I permit myself to send to you the attached thesis. The printing of it has been presented up to now through external circumstances, and hence, because of that, I am sending you an abschrift, a copy of it. Your esteemed sir will see out of it that I have completely read your highly treasured writings, which have given me much stimulation. I believe it must be earnestly made against that grasping of the world which wants to recognize only atoms and mechanical processes. My thesis appears to me to touch the point, the essential point upon which all of it hangs. The linkish style, the clumsy style, and perhaps the points which I have not merely presented clearly, should not really detract from the thesis. I have myself quietly lived into the mechanical, materialistic way of looking upon nature, and I once upon a time have sworn about its truth, as many other people are doing it. But I have also been able to recognize the contradictions in it, and also I myself have lived through these contradictions. So what I'm presenting is hence not merely dialectic, but it is my own inner experience. Because I know how I thought then, I can recognize this world conception in its deepest being, and it'd be much easier for me to recognize his defects than for someone else who hadn't gone through my very deep natural scientific studies. My studies are mathematics and science. Now, the viewpoints which your esteemed sir have about Darwinism appear to me to be the germinal aspects for the judgments of a later time. Of a correction of the concept of time, one has to really look forward to so as to be the salvation of science. Certainly on this way more can be reached than through the useless attempts of people like Carneris and others, which want to bring Darwinism also with its untruths and unclarity in complete union with the realm of ethics. Finally, I permit myself, if your esteemed sir does not find this request cheap and unbillig, if you don't find this request unfair, I would very much ask you to impart to me your opinions about what I have sent you as a treatise. If it seems to me that I'm being too bold and I'm going beyond the limits of ordinary politeness, so perhaps you will excuse this as for my very glowing zealousness for truth. And the thoughts that your esteemed sir, you'll pardon me as one of your reverers, if I hope you don't consider what I'm sending you is it can be as impudence. With very much reverence, Rudolf Steiner. Address in the morning of Brunn am Gebirge, Lower Austria. Now we have something written in the year 1886, an extract of what Rudolf Steiner wrote, and apropos this, he says, "So was my glance directed on the path from the sense observation to the spiritual, because in me I stood always in inward cognitive life. I was looking behind the sense type of phenomena, not for unspiritual world of atoms, but for the spiritual, which apparently reveals itself within the inner being of man, but which in reality itself belongs to the sense things and the sense processes. It arises through the relationship of the apparency arises through the way of holding himself of the cognizing person. It arises, one feels apparently, as if the thoughts of things are within the human being, whereas in reality they hold sway within the things. Man has necessary to separate them in a apparent experience from the things. In true life of cognition, he gives it back to the things. The development of the world is then so to be understood that the preceding unspiritual, out of which later on there unfolds itself the spirituality of the human being, besides and outside of itself, it has a spiritual. The later, through-spirited sense world in which the human being appears through the fact that the spiritual ancestors of the human being unite themselves with imperfect non-spiritual forms and then transforming them so that then they appear in a sense aspect form. This process of ideas led me beyond the theoretical epistemologists of that time, whose sharp sense and scientific sense of responsibility I fully recognized. This process of thoughts led me beyond them. They led me to Goethe. I must today look back upon my inner battling of that time. I didn't make it easy for myself to depart from the way of thinking of the philosophers of that time. My illuminating star was always the self-effected recognition of the fact that man can perceive himself as a spirit independent of his body and standing in a pure spiritual world. Of my work about Goethe's natural scientific writing and of this cognitive theory, I wrote a small thesis about atomism, which was never published. It was held in the direction I've just signified. I must think how much joy it came to me when I sent it to Friedrich Theodor Fischer, and he wrote me, replying back, several agreeable words.